This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. According to Michelle Obama, that lean-in stuff doesn't work anymore. Women can't always have it all, or at least not easily. She reportedly talked about that during a tour stop for her new book, and she was referring to the popular movement championed by Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg that advised women to lean in to take control of their careers. But the fact that a female tech executive and a former first lady even have a platform to debate the power of leaning in may be the result of the work done by feminist artists from the 60s and the 70s. Kimberly Lam is an associate professor of gender, sexuality, feminist studies at Duke University. Her new book is called Addressing the Other Woman, and it documents the work of some of these feminist artists. Kimberly, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm really appreciative.
Let's talk a little bit more about how you got into this, because we're going to talk about feminist art, but the fact is that you are very interested in the way feminism affects everybody today, particularly women, whether they know it or not. Right?
Yeah, that's a real interest of mine. I think of my own introduction to feminism as being less than direct. My mother introduced me to feminist ideas through her embrace of an idea that was kind of vague but important, that women didn't have to be in unhappy marriages, right? That's a kind of a basic premise that she built a life on and made some important decisions about. And I recall very clearly texts from popular culture, paperback books and movies kind of being around. I remember Nancy Friday's book, The Women's Room, where the women's room is scrawled over the ladies' room. And I stole that from my mom and read it in secret. But these things kind of attest to the ways in which feminism kind of shapes people's lives, even if they aren't activists, even if they aren't running as CEO or first ladies. And I think that inspired my interest in feminist art, because art is less than direct. It's not a political stance or necessarily even an identity, but it attests to how feminism can kind of reshape our perceptions of ourselves and other people.
But art is intentional, whether or not it is
yes.
It's intentionally political.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
It is intentional, unlike your mother. I mean, and of course, what your mother was saying was intentional too. But it
yes.
was a very, out of a personal experience that many, many people shared.
And sure.
That, of course, is what made it political. But
right.
Talk about the artists and their intentions as you saw them, as you profile them in your book.
So I focus on three artists of many, many women artists who were at work in the late 60s and the 1970s, Adrian Piper, Nancy Spiro, and Mary Kelly. These are prominent, well-known artists now, but they struggled for visibility in the 1960s and 70s. Adrian Piper just recently had a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art, so she's definitely getting the time and space that she deserves. Piper is a philosopher, and an artist. She's the first artist to bring conceptual art to bear on questions of race and gender, and she worked with the interplay of words and images to really break down how sexism and racism shapes how people see, what she identified as kind of the visual pathologies of racism and sexism, which I think connects back to the previous segment. I think she would see the icon of the black man with a gun as part of a visual pathology that people don't reflect on. And she used language and addressed viewers to get them to read images and read icons of black women and understand that the culture's fears and fantasies are projected upon their bodies.
And interestingly enough, yeah. while we think about the visual and certainly mm-hmm. what we're hearing over and over again with shootings and some of the what we talked about in the last segment mm-hmm. is the fear of the black male body, right?
Right.
A visual image
right.
that. And yet, when you talk about Piper, she uses a lot of text. And,
yes.
And the message there, at least to me, is mm-hmm. the way in which ideology, the way in which we describe things verbally, then
right.
becomes is superimposed on the image that you sort of just carry with you.
Sure.
I carry my body with me. But you keep telling me these things, and I keep reading about these things. It's in your law.
Right, right. I think part of what she was trying to do, as well as the other artists, Nancy Spiro and Mary Kelly, is layer the images, layer perceptions with complications that we have to engage with and read and understand. So reading here means analyzing, scrutinizing, questioning, taking a step back, not taking something in, absorbing it and consuming it instantaneously, as we're kind of encouraged to do in contemporary visual culture.
One of the works even represents or mimics the Rosetta Stone,
yes.
Right? That great icon of interpretation.
Right, right. Thank you for mentioning that. That's part of Mary Kelly's postpartum document, and it's the last part of a very long and large installation. She draws on the visual grammar of the Rosetta Stone to show her show a mother's documenting her son's acquisition of language, and this is a site of tremendous desire and loss for the maternal figure in Mary Kelly's postpartum document, and what it's showing is the mother's desire, what the mother sees, and for Mary Kelly, this is something that wasn't readily available in visual culture. We have, we certainly have images of women, but we don't have images of women seeing from the position of their own desire and loss. And the idea of this Rosetta Stone as something that was lost and then found has all these resonances for her.
And its power to interpret. And
right.
I think it's an ingenious work of art in
right.
the sense that you have the scrawl of a youngster trying to right. learn to write as the kind of the top layer.
Right.
And then a kind of a simple text, and then a far more academic text is in these three
right.
tiers, right?
Right.
But the work, and I considered it, it appeared to me to be an ingenious work all by itself, but it wasn't received that way.
No, I think it was hard for it to gain visibility. Certainly in small circles, Kelly's postpartum document was well received. There was the early part of postpartum document where she actually displays the sheaths of her child's diapers and puts on and annotates them with notes about what the child ate. This is the work that maternal figures have to do when you're weaning the child from breastfeeding that, you know, is embarrassing and no one wants to talk about. She made it part of this very serious exhibition, and she was excoriated in the press. She talks about the fact that she has a file of the newspaper clippings where the British tabloid press were, you know, sort of yelling with the headlines, dirty nappies, and she writes about that as being traumatic to encounter how much heat she got for being positioned as a bad, perverse, horrible mother, which is so readily available for us even now. And but she looks back on that that event as really doing something, exposing the taboos of the museum, exposing what women are allowed to make visible, what they're supposed to keep hidden, and so the work really created an intervention, but it's often with controversy through right. which things change.
Well, and the controversy is fascinating because that uh-huh. shines a light on exactly where the fault lines are, where
right.
the prejudices, where
right.
where they break. In
right.
other words, there's two ways you can, in any liberation movement, right, you can go at least two ways. One of them is to say, we don't have to take that role anymore. I'm not going to be the mother. I'm not going to be the daughter,
right.
right? I mean, I don't have to do that. I can do these. The other is to say, being a mother and being a daughter is far more important than you ever thought. And
right.
I'm going to bring this into a museum, and I'm going to bring this
exactly.
into other public spaces in ways that elevate it to the importance of your accounting and other work that you do.
Right.
And that's where she got in trouble. It's like, what
right.
are you doing with a diaper in this museum?
That's for the garbage.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. So I'm really glad that you brought that up because as you said, postpartum document is often not well received or well understood. But what she's trying to do is kind of shift the value that's placed on women's work and make that visible, she's pointing to the expectations that women naturally embody this kind of maternal ideal, but she's also pointing to the ways in which that's devalued in culture.
Now, we haven't talked yet about Nancy Sparrow. Tell us more about her.
Yeah, she was an artist at work in the 1960s and 1970s. She really went against the grain of abstract expressionism because she worked with text. She also worked with the figure. Her work really engages with the idea of the white woman embodying the feminist mystique. She was a wife and a mother of three boys. She was married to a well-known artist, Leon Golub, and her work was always kind of marginalized as the work of the housewife. Even when she exhibited early on in Chicago, the headline was "Housewife Exhibits Art." So, but she created in the 1970s this wonderful large installation piece called Codex Arto, and it has strange little figures with indeterminate sex, and then all of these texts from the poetry of Artaud, and really creates a kind of large-scale claim to aggression that she felt and many of her cohorts felt women weren't allowed to have.
What was the power of these, or the effect of these? Let me go back one step and talk about intention, because we raised that earlier.
Right.
Whether or not they saw themselves as feminist artists.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge issue. I think Spiro definitely did. She was involved in protests and political groups that tried to intervene in the institutions of the art museums. And so she didn't have an issue with feminist art. Piper to some degree disidentifies with the category of feminist art because partially because she sees feminism as being a failure. That has to do with race and the ways in which her work is really focused on racial and sexual and racial difference. And so there's a disidentification there. I would say, though, that her Piper's work has what I would call feminist effects, right? I mean, it's galvanizing in a feminist way for people who see it, right? And so one of the things I grappled with in the book is sort of thinking about how to examine artwork that is positioned in relationship to feminism and think about its effects and not only the intentions of the artist, which is always important, but it's not the whole thing.
Well, that's what I want to get to next, and that is the effect, and whether or not this only had an impact on the art world or to what extent it may have affected much of what we see today, if there's been any progress at all.
I think that something like Me Too kind of harkens back to this earlier moment and the use of text. With Me Too, there's a creation of a textual community, you could say, that I think these artists were working hard to create in the 1960s and 70s. One of the things that I think that they were doing with text was reaching out to viewers, reaching out to other women and trying to create a community, trying to work against the isolation of women. Me Too is something similar to that. It's also saying, you know, it's about women having a say about how their bodies appear and what the image of their bodies mean. I think that I don't think we've gone as, you know, we've overcome many of the issues that feminist art raised in the 1960s and 70s, but one of the things they ask us to do is to kind of let go of our idea of progress and not always measure feminism in terms of progress. They were invested, I would say, in what Juliet Mitchell calls the long revolution, and that these ideas about racial and sexual subordination are taking place, you know, in what Mary Kelly would identify as the unconscious. And so they aren't going to be overcome quickly, and we are going to be continue to be kind of stunned about the frequency with which these issues continue to appear.
Let's talk about, though, this is the tough question, I think, for somebody who spent as much time on these artists, because this is the real outsider question.
Sure.
And it has to do with the fact that what if they hadn't been here? What if that art, would we be where we are today? Or to what extent do you think you can trace any of of their work in these movements today. And a part of that is, you know, sort of a question that implies that art may be too far outside of the mainstream to have an impact. There's an implication in that question that suggests that. And that's really what I'm getting at.
Well, they were part of the beginning of what we identify as contemporary art in the late 1960s and 1970s, even though that was, you know, a half a century ago. They helped to make possible the presence of women and people of color in the art world. And there's such a huge explosion now of contemporary art, particularly that's focused on issues of race and gender and sexuality. 20 years ago, it was hard to see contemporary art. You had to go to Los Angeles or New York, and now you can see it at the Nasher, right? And there's a whole kind of academic field that's around contemporary art. Contemporary art, Martha Rosler talks about this. Contemporary art is sort of part of now leisure culture or entertainment culture. Mm. We go to the MoMA when we go to New York City. We don't have to be experts in art in that way. And so I do think that they, you know, they made an impact on that. They do, their work helped solidify the ways in which visual images really police what women's bodies are allowed to do. And in with my students, I see that's something that they understand. That's something that they see, that's something that they carry to their own lives, and that's something that they comment on in social media when they're participating in visual culture.
Kimberly Lamb, an associate professor of gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Duke University. Her new book is called Addressing the Other Woman. Kimberly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was nice to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. We've got links at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.